Everyone here knows, of course, what Pixar is. I hope it's an it's this animation studio, and it's probably one of the greatest cultural forces of our sort of last 10, 15 years. It's actually been almost 20 years since Toy Story first came on the scene, and The Onion, which is a satirical newspaper, which I just get a huge kick out of. They publish tons of fake headlines. And I just thought I'd start with this. 5-year-old critics agree, movie Cars only gets better after 40th viewing. According to a poll of 5-year-old film critics released Tuesday, the 2006 Disney Pixar animated feature Cars only gets better after the 40th viewing. The tow truck talks funny, and he has big teeth, said cineaste Ramon Diaz, 5. Adding that it takes at least 30 screenings before the film's message of friendship achieves full resonance. Let's watch it again. The poll's respondents also agreed that Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is a weird and scary film they wish their parents would stop trying to make them watch. That's just neither here nor there. That's just a joke. But I do think it speaks maybe a little bit to the cultural influence that Pixar has had, because many of us here, I think, have small children or are small children inside, and we have enjoyed these films, and they have spoken to us. But thank you for having me here, and especially thanks to Matt and Megan and for Pastor Dykes for welcoming me. This has just been a great, exciting opportunity. I've never been to Texas, believe it or not, but I have watched Friday Night Lights, and I do think it's the best television show ever. So I was a youth minister for a number of years, and I was constantly being asked by wonderful students and kids who had all the right intentions in the world, and they would always ask me, what kind of music should I listen to? What kind of movies should I watch? And that's an important question. But there's a deeper question that they're not asking, and this is going to come back to Pixar. But it's a question that opens the movie High Fidelity. Those of you who have seen the movie, it's a romantic comedy. The protagonist says, we talk so much about violent video games and contact sports and the impact that those are having on our children. Are they creating a violent atmosphere, shootings in schools, etc.? But what about the thousands, and I mean thousands of songs about heartbreak, pain, and romantic agony that we listen to from the cradle to the grave? Does that have any bearing on our emotional state? And he finishes, he asks the question, he says, do I listen to pop music because I'm miserable, or am I miserable because I listen to pop music? And that's the question that I'm interested in. And when the church, when Christians only focus on the shoulds or shouldn'ts, we miss an opportunity to go deeper. Because the shoulds or shouldn'ts, those are superficial questions. The why is always more important than the what. It is a question that Jesus addresses. In Mark, many of you know Mark 7. This is verse 14 through 23. Again, Jesus called the crowd to him and said, listen to me, everyone, and understand this. Nothing outside a person can defile them by going into them. Rather, it is what comes out of a person that defiles them. After he had left the crowd and entered the house, the disciple asked him about this parable. Are you so dull, he asked. Don't you see that nothing that enters a person from the outside can defile them? For it doesn't go into their heart, but into their stomach and then out of the body. He went on, what comes out of a person is what defiles them. For it is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come. Sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and defile a person. What I believe that Christ is saying there is that sin is something that flows inside out. It goes one direction. It is something that is not achieved. It is something that is inherited. The Bible is constantly talking about the inheritance of sin. It is a condition. It is also, of course, it manifests itself in certain actions and compulsive behaviors that we all know, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Not the rock and roll, obviously. But it is something that starts from within. So art, culture, media, if I'm to take Jesus at his word here, I believe that it may have the power to influence, it may have the power to shape, it may have the power to impact, but it does not have the ability to create something inside that's not already there. In order for something like a pop song to make me miserable, there has to be a foothold that it finds that's already miserable inside me. So, do I listen to pop music because I'm miserable? Or am I miserable because I listen to pop music? Jesus' answer, as I understand it, is that you listen to pop music because you're miserable. My example of this is when I was a teenager and I was very angry. My father moved us around a lot. It just so happened that I got into very angry music. Nirvana, Guns N' Roses, all these sorts of things. And my parents, it drove them crazy. They'd come into my room and Metallica would be blaring, you know? And my parents are wonderful Christian believers and they just could not relate, you know? It was just a phase, but, you know, they could forbid it, but that just made it more exciting. And come to find out, once I got a few more friends in the place we were living, once I grew up a little bit, once maybe I stopped feeling so afraid of girls, still afraid of them a little bit, I started listening to other kinds of music. It was an internal outside thing. The music wasn't making me angry. I was angry, therefore I was listening to the angry music. So when we fear culture, when we censor it or we retreat from it, rather than engage it, when we judge it, we don't have to do that. We don't have to do that. And Chris is going to talk more about that later. But when we cast it as forbidden fruit, as we put the blame on the culture, we are always ignoring the log in our own eye. So, okay, that's just a way to bring out why even talk about culture. The next reason to talk about Pixar, talk about anything like this, is the purpose and potential of art and story. You know, the church has used art. You know, it was the benefactor, the forum of all great art, basically until about 1940. But the church understood that if you hear the gospel directly from the pulpit, if the pulpit is the place where you hear proclamation, you hear the good news, you know, the news that God loves you and has died for you and has redeemed you, that is a direct way of communicating, and that is very effective. But many of us have walls up, and we can't hear that, or we can only hear that in one specific part of our lives, that we need to also be gotten at from the sides, from the back, from all other sort of indirect means of communication. That art and story has the power to penetrate defenses. And that even us who are would consider ourselves Christians, even we erect boxes for the gospel in our life. It applies here, but maybe not here. It's okay on Sunday, but don't talk to me, you know, when I'm at the football game. I need to worship that. That's just Friday Night Lights, clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose. But art can be, and story particularly, can be an avenue for the gospel to reach you in a place that maybe you didn't even know you needed to be reached. And that's what indirect communication does. That's what music, that's what story, that's what film, that's what paintings can do. They can reveal to you who you are and where you are. Good art is like a mirror, oftentimes. Maybe you've had an experience where you were sitting in a movie theater and you started crying. You don't really know why you started crying. But something reminded you of maybe some incident in your childhood. Or you were listening to a song that just came on in a department store. And you were overcome with emotion. And you didn't know maybe what was going on. You felt like you were in the grip of something. But it had this indirect, your defenses were down. They weren't up. And so you got just clocked in the head with some serious feeling. And that, if only, to say nothing about beauty, if only for its potential to reach our hearts, to penetrate past our well-defended, guarded hearts, so the Bible diagnoses us, then story should be, you know, it should be held up. We should look to story. We should look to narrative. We should look to novels. We should look to powerful films. The very heartstrings that Pixar films pull on are the same heartstrings on which the message of the forgiveness of sins needs to be played. So, I would say that very few other studios, film studios, have had the ability to consistently reach people's hearts across the broadest possible spectrum than Pixar. Maybe you are a parent to a small child and you have watched these movies way too many times that it's just obnoxious and you're sort of surprised you're here because you don't need to hear anything more about Buzz Lightyear. But Pixar is a fascinating thing, and the reason I talk about it, I'm obviously using Pixar as a model for looking at culture in general. But Pixar is good, so we can. It's got a little bit more. We're on pretty firm ground. It's a company that was started in, I think, the late 70s as a technology company. It was quickly bought by George Lucas, Star Wars guy, and Steve Jobs, Saint Steve Jobs. He's not a saint, but that's how we treat him, it seems like. He bought the company in 1986. And he took all of his money that he got from when he was ousted from Apple, and he sunk it into this company that lost money for something like 6 years. Finally, Disney agreed to distribute their first feature film, which was Toy Story, and the rest is history. These movies have grossed more money than any other studio in the course of, I think, 15 years. I think they brought in something like $4.5 billion worldwide, something absurd. But what you find with Pixar, and one of the reasons we're talking about them, is their approach to storytelling is kind of novel. They don't, they're always character first. Commercial consideration last. Character first, then plot, then anything related to product placement or anything like that. You'll notice that unlike the Shrek movies, they're not parodying anything. It's all original stories. They're not adaptations. That's, you know, we live in a world where if you've been to the multiplex recently, everything is a remake or a sequel. Pixar's bringing out original stories. And that's enough to take note anyway. They're not sarcastic, but they're fun. They're fun if they're like adults enjoy them. There is a family focus to these films. And they're interested in serious things. If you watch Pixar films, the reason you cry is because they're talking about things like identity. They're talking about purpose. They're talking about belonging, fear, love, death, forgiveness. Yes, even salvation. There's a generous spirit behind them. But perhaps the most... I was reading this thing in The New Yorker about Pixar, and they said that the greatest achievement that Pixar... has actually had is that they have been able to apply fresh cement between the generations. That an 8-year-old, 10-year-old boy whose iPod is filled with absurd music that his grandmother could never like or listen to or be at all interested in, they can both go to the movie Up and find it exciting and interesting and touching, and they can both cry when they realize what's really going on in that movie. And when something has such universal appeal, Christians who claim to deal in universality, we have a message for all people. You know, God so loved the world. You know, this is we believe it's true. Not just true for Christians. It's true, period. That when there's something universal going on like that, or approaching that, we need to sit up and take note. So I'll just sum up the approach that I try to take to these movies, and just like any cultural artifact. We don't read into them. These are not Christian films. This is not The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. This is not allegory. But we read out of. We don't read into, we read out of. We look to film because it's not only a storytelling torpedo to the heart, but it's a communal experience. It's something we experience together. It can bring us closer rather than isolate us. So we're not trying to instrumentalize these movies. We're not trying to turn them into ideological instruments. But to the extent that they're dealing in anything real, and if they're making you cry, they probably are. That's not always true, but it's kind of true. To the extent that they're dealing with anything real, we can find points of connection. A lot of times Christians, and I speak for, you know, I was brought up in a wonderful Christian home, but we focus on the points of disconnection with popular culture rather than the points of connection. And as a result, we live in a very divided society. It's not all, you know, we don't take the blame completely. But we live in a society where there's us versus them. And you know what? We're in desperate need of bridges. I don't care where you are ideologically, we need bridges to the world. We need bridges to ourselves, to our loved ones, to those, you know, estranged people in our families. We need anything we can get. We need points of connection. We don't need any more points of disconnection. And I think we can apply that approach to Pixar, and that really stands up, that we can turn culture into an opportunity rather than an enemy, recognizing that we are part of it. We are part of it. You go see these movies too. Chris is going to talk more about what that means in terms of the larger raising of children and et cetera. But a few more points about Pixar before we're not just going to talk about the menu. We're going to actually eat the food. We're actually watch a couple clips and talk about maybe where I see the points of connection. Give you maybe some tools, hopefully, you can take home. But there's a lot of movies with redemptive themes and themes that you can find gospel themes in. What makes Pixar such a treasure trove of material? I'd say there's three reasons. First one is that not all movies with redemptive themes are very good. There's a lot of crazy ones out there that aren't very good. I mean, there's no accounting for taste, but a lot of things that are marketed as Christian films are just poor quality. It's embarrassing. Some of them are great, don't get me wrong, but not all. Pixar films are of undeniably high quality. They're cutting edge technology-wise. The scripting, the voice acting, the art direction, the thematic coherency, the music, the clever humor, the emotional depth, they win Academy Awards every single time for a reason. They're works of art. They somehow manage to appeal to that incredibly broad audience, cutting across pretty much all demographics, but without stooping to lowest common denominator gags. It's not cheap humor in these movies. That's easy. Pixar's clever. So they're good. That's why we need to... They're beautiful. God is involved in beauty. Two, among the studios that are making family films, Pixar, I would say, has the most biblical understanding of human nature. Its grasp on the internal dynamics of the human heart is second... is unbelievably sympathetic. What do I mean by that? The protagonists themselves tend to be their own worst enemies. These are not stories of, generally, not stories of good versus evil. They are stories of someone shooting themselves in the foot until finally, through some sense of suffering, they wake up and things get a little bit better. There's usually a break in the clouds, a sort of deus ex machina, you know, God coming down from the clouds. But I'm talking about Woody in Toy Story 2, and Mr. Incredible in The Incredibles, Marlin in Finding Nemo, Remy in Ratatouille. All of these guys, all of these characters, their primary conflicts are internal ones. These movies often get criticized because they don't have very strong villains. Because, you know, the Bible tells us that we are both children of God and completely fallen, broken individuals. We are our own worst enemy. Paul talks about, the spirit and the flesh, this internal battle that goes on. We see it all the time in Pixar movies, and it jives with reality. That's what our life is like. People tend not to be just pure evil or pure good. Everyone is some kind of mix of these things, depending on sort of what they ate for breakfast or the kind of week they had, or maybe how they were brought up, the type of home they had. It's rarely a matter of a hero reaching deep inside themselves to realize their potential. The adventures almost always actually humble the hero. And from a point of humility, they sort of are resurrected, a point of desperation. There's usually almost inevitably a scene of repentance in these movies, turning around. And redemption tends to occur in the form of an intervening event rather than a person pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. So there's a powerful salvation thread. But third, lastly, Pixar films touch on universal themes and concerns. As I said, they're fanciful. These are, fairy tales. We're talking about toys and fish and, rats. My wife had a hard time with that one. Superheroes. But they're all human, stand-ins. We want Wally to get the girl. We hope that Marlin will lighten up. Their struggles become our own. We are swept up into the story because we see ourselves in these characters. So while Woody may be a pull-string toy cowboy, at its core, his story is one of anxiety and salvation. So these films speak on a number of different levels, and they unwittingly coax the heart and the imagination of the audience into a fuller engagement with ourselves and with the world. They are not moral fables. They tend not to be. But they do have. They're not didactic. They're not sort of telling you at the end of the story, well, and this is why you should ultimately, vote Democrat. Sometimes if you watch some certain movies, that's all you hear is the political overtone. These have a much deeper sort of narrative potential to get you in touch with things that go beyond those, your family, your inner child. And whenever you're in the realm of the inner child, I think you're in the realm of the gospel. I mean, Jesus says the kingdom belongs to such as these. Who of us isn't a child or wishes that we were still in our childhood? Those are the precious moments, the formative moments. And Chris is going to talk, or I'm going to talk a little bit more about that tomorrow when we look at Ratatouille. But finally, looking at Pixar, we look at Pixar because it's okay to have some fun with the gospel. I think sometimes Christians need permission. It's all right to play, to have some fun with this stuff. If this is a description of reality, then surely it applies to anything that's real. But let's have a little fun. We don't need to be defensive all the time. It's exciting to be a little decompartmentalized, to see that despite the fantastical elements, these movies are deeply concerned with the realities of loss, suffering, defeat, death. And I think if you're like me, you might be relieved to be reminded that the gospel addresses reality, not just Christian reality. Okay, so we're at our first example, which is Toy Story. I thought we'd start with the beginning. The story of Toy Story is a story of toys. that's funny. It is Andy's playroom. Andy is a young boy. His father is nowhere to be seen, but the mother's in all the movies. And, fill in the blanks. But it's really the first Toy Story is the story of Buzz Lightyear. And he is this new, brand new toy, this Space Ranger toy, who gets introduced into this playroom that is full of slightly more antiquated classic toys like Mr. Potato Head and the Slinky Dog and, the dinosaur and the piggy bank. And Buzz Lightyear is suffering, almost the entire movie, he's suffering from the delusion that he actually is a Space Ranger sent to Earth to defeat the Emperor Zurg. He believes that his laser is deadly, that he can fly on command. He has been given a mission from Star Command, and he's determined to fulfill it. And despite Star Command's silence and Woody the cowboy's emphatic suggestions, not to mention gravity, Buzz believes that he is a real Space Ranger. It is a story about identity. This makes for a lot of clever comedy, of course, but Buzz eventually comes back down to Earth and is confronted with the obvious reality that he is a toy. And we're going to watch a scene after Buzz and Woody have been kind of kidnapped by the kid across the street, Sid, who, you know, again, he's not an actual villain. He's just the event that produces the conflict within Buzz and Woody. And they have been kidnapped, and Buzz has just realized that maybe he's not a space ranger. And let's watch it.
What chance does a toy like me have against a Buzz like your action figure? All I can do is... Why would Andy ever want to play with me if he's got you? I'm the one that should be strapped to that rock. You should get out of here while you can. Buzz, what are you doing?
Come on, Sheriff. There's a kid over in that house who needs us. Now let's get you out of this thing.
Yes, sir. Come on, Buzz, we can do it. We'll be right back.
That's it. Okay. So what a great scene. What an amazing scene. What we find out is that Buzz, when we get to the beginning of that scene, he's been faced with the reality of who he actually is. And all he can see are his inadequacies. And that could be unbearable, but he is confronted. Reality wins out in people's lives. We don't have to sort of scream it at them. And though we can try like Buzz to ignore it, it will eventually, as I said, win out. But in Buzz's despair, it's actually a necessity for him to see that as a toy, is loved by Andy and even marked as his own. Now, I mean, come on. How obvious is what they're talking about here? And I'm not saying, you know, John Lasseter, I've read, he's the director and writer of the film. I don't know if he's a Christian. But the idea that Buzz's insistence on asserting his false identity, his flawed understanding of who he is, puts himself and all the toys at great risk. His denial is more than unfortunate and misinformed. It is dangerous. But when he's at his very lowest point, he is told that he is not a space ranger, but he is actually a toy. He's Andy's toy. He belongs to someone. And he's not loved. What does he say? He says, he doesn't love you because of, you know, you've got all these attributes. Your helmet goes back like that. But look at you. You're Buzz Lightyear. God loves us, as we are told, for who we are. Not for what we do. You know, the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation talked about this in terms of works righteousness versus the, you know, righteousness by faith. We are loved, we are marked as Christ's own because of what he has done, because of who he is. What matters in life ultimately is not what other people think about you or what you think about you, it's what God thinks about you. And what happens to him? That reality, when he reads Andy, the brand on his sneaker, on the bottom of his shoe, he's energized like that. And he starts to help. He doesn't need to be told, well, now that you're a toy, now let me give you a list of things you have to, your obligations as a toy. No, he receives that love, and love, when it's received, produces fruit. He jumps to, he saves his friend, and they have that kind of funny moment. So Buzz is saved from his despair through the assurance that he belongs to and is loved by Andy. To see oneself as just a toy is to look at life as it really is. To see one's failure and hurt and accept them, knowing that God has dealt with them. So that's just how I see the gospel playing out in Toy Story. What I would consider to be the most profound of the movies, which is not my favorite of them, but I think it is the most, ultimately the most, one of the most spiritual significance, is Finding Nemo. And we're about to watch a clip from Finding Nemo. Finding Nemo is the story of Marlin, really, not Nemo. Story of Marlin, who is a clownfish, I believe. And at the beginning of the movie, he's bursting with enthusiasm for life. He's got a wife named Coral, and he eagerly awaits the birth of their 100 larvae. He's just bought a new house, a sea, an anemone, or whatever however you say it, with a fantastic view of the ocean, right next to the drop-off. And yet Marlin's joy for life is suddenly extinguished in the opening moments of the movie, when a violent barracuda comes through and kills his wife and all but one of his children. In his grief, Marlin becomes paranoid and fearful. And who couldn't have compassion on that? This is a children's movie in which this happens in the first, 10 minutes. We should take note. They're dealing with real things. They're not dealing with a fantasy world. So after the death of his wife, Marlin vows that nothing will ever happen to his son, Nemo. And understandably, Marlin becomes a burdensome and overprotective parent. He becomes a controlling parent. That the one thing Nemo is told to remember about the ocean is that it's not safe. Marlin is constantly curbing Nemo's adventurous spirit. He overcorrects for his faulty flipper. He's what's called a helicopter parent. Maybe it's the phenomenon in our culture right now. A parent that does all the work for the child, that doesn't teach them how to fish, pun intended, but keeps giving them fish over and over again. You know, to quote the maxim. So instead of joining with the fish of his own age when they get to school, Marlin suggested Nemo play on the sponge beds with the infants. That's kind of, you know, a little boy's nightmare. So Marlin is a parent that's motivated by fear, understandably, but he's afraid of everything and anyone. Sometimes this is how Christian parents are perceived, by the way. It's how a lot of parents are perceived and how they experience the world. But this is just, you know, just FYI. He seeks to minimize every risk and prevent every foreseeable negative outcome. That every new situation provides new opportunities for danger. That Marlin lives in a perpetual state of anxiety. Yet the feeling of being in control provides for Marlin the only possibility of peace and security. And of course, he never actually feels totally in control, so he's constantly overcompensating for everyone around him. So it's not that Marlin shouldn't be a protective parent. Of course, we should protect our children. It's that it turns into something different when you're protecting a child for their sake or when it becomes about you. Control tends to be actually about the parent rather than the child. Helicopter parents, if you meet them, and I know none of us have ever met one, that is all about, you talk to their children, and you know immediately that it's the parent working out their issues through the child, not the child's problems. So Marlin is protective, but not for Nemo's sake. He has, it is Marlin versus the world, and there's no one to help him. So like all sort of attempts to control other people, it's counterproductive. You know, what does St. Paul say? He says that the law increases the trespass. The more we try to tamp down and micromanage people, the more they want to rebel. You know, before the law, sin lay dead. Then it came in and I found myself alive to sin. That's a paraphrasing, obviously. But forbidden fruit in culture does the exact same thing. So what happens is that Nemo is kind of running away from his dad at one point, and he gets caught by a diver. Marlin's worst fear, all of his attempts to control, backfire. And he is thrust into this world of uncertainty and going after his son. So we're going to watch this clip that begins with Marlin, the father, joined by the absent-minded Dory. It's kind of the comic relief in the film. And they've set off after Nemo, who they believe has been taken to a place called P. Sherman 42 Wallaby Way, Sydney, Australia. That's sort of, they don't understand what that means, but he's been taken to Australia. And after numerous setbacks, they are lost and unsure about what to do next. Play the clip.
Come on. can't never let anything happen to him. Then nothing would ever happen to him. Not much fun for little Harper.
Okay, what a wonderful clip. This is the turning point of the movie. This is the Ghost of Christmas Future scene, if you're a Scrooge fan. What has happened is they're obviously inside the whale, and they have two options. Marlin can either hold on to the taste bud, or he can let go and drop into the back of the whale's throat. Holding on seems to be safer. The more secure option. And he knows he can hold on to the taste bud. Maybe he can outlast the whale's patience. Maybe he can find a way past the bushy teeth, which are called baleen, I think. I found that out. Little trivia for you. The second option doesn't appear to be all that attractive, and his traveling companion claims that she can speak whale. Yet, of course, what is he doing? As any person who's really controlling, he starts to lash out and blame. You can't speak whale. This is all your fault. Now we're, you know, everything is a blame game. Why should I trust this whale? Don't whales eat fish? And of course, these alternatives symbolize the two ways that Marlin could possibly live his life. Holding on or letting go. Or you could say control versus faith. Make no mistake, control and faith are opposites. Up until this point, all Marlin has been doing is holding on. To Nemo, to security, to familiarity, and finally to the taste bud. Despite his best efforts, this approach has produced the exact opposite of what he wanted. Holding on has left him isolated from the rest of the reef. It has driven away his son and led him into his current life-threatening situation, where he's anxious to the point of collapse. It would mean risking his security for the highly uncertain possibility that things might turn out better to drop. But if Marlon stays in the mouth, he'll die. And, I mean, you could say that the very thing he thinks is going to bring him life is actually the thing that's killing him. Now, if that's not a biblical diagnosis of the human condition, I don't know what is. The very things that we think will bring us life actually bring us the opposite. That we don't know what's best for us. That's God's realm. We tend to think in our lives that holding on, working hard, managing risks, doing what is expected of us will bring our life stability. So the word, go to the back of the throat or give up, is often heard to us as a death sentence. We think that if we can just hold on for a little longer, we might actually get out by our own effort. We think that we must argue and struggle to get what we want, no matter what the cost. And if we don't fight for what we want, no one else will. Marlon falls victim to the same thing that all of us fall victim to, calling a bad thing good and a good thing bad. Letting go, giving up on yourself, may seem like unattractive or seem irresponsible, but it is probably the only way forward. It is certainly the only way forward for Marlon. While laboring for what you want, expressed here in the form of vigilant parenting, may appear attractive and good, it nevertheless can accomplish the opposite of what's intended. It can drive your children away. Now, I met Matt and Megan in New York, and this is a city filled with people who are running away from controlling parents. Maybe you're running away from a controlling parent. That applies to children, and, you know, all of us are children. So letting go, violence here, this extreme humbling situation, this dire, desperate situation that Marlon is put in, is actually the work of God. And that is what we call the theology of the cross. The theology of the cross says that God works through pain, through suffering, to bring about his redemptive purposes. Through the opposite of what we think he's going to work through. Flannery O'Connor, the Southern novelist, put it this way. Said, I suppose the reasons for the use of so much violence in modern fiction will differ for each writer who uses it, but in my own stories, I have found that violence is strangely capable of returning my characters to reality and preparing them for them accept their moment of grace. Their heads are so hard that almost nothing else will do that will do the work. This idea that reality is something to which we must be returned at considerable cost is one which is seldom understood by the casual reader, but it is one which is implicit in the Christian view of the world. That's all she's saying, is that people are so hard-hearted and so turned in on themselves. Incurvatus in se is the Augustine's term for it. We are so resistant to God, even post-regeneration, that they have to be broken by God through awful experiences so that they let go, so that he can save them. A death sentence is actually all he needs. Doesn't God work? God, the one thing he needs to save you is your death. You guys are Baptists. That's what baptism is about, dying and being reborn. Marlon looks probable death in the face and is forced into a world of uncertainty. But life is found not through holding on to what seems secure or pushing toward his goals, but through letting go. But he's made to give up. This is not a choice. He does not say, you know, I've weighed my options, and I think the right choice is just to let go. Now I'm going to really try really hard to let go. No, he is forced to let go. And if any of you have dealt with addictions or personal compulsive behavior, you know that a bottoming out experience is the place where people meet God and are saved by him. And that's a profound thing. That is the most amazing way God works in the world. It is in these deaths, painful and frightening as they are, that we are reborn. Later, a chapter later in Mark, Jesus says, or the writer, Mark writes, then he called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me and the gospel will save it. What good is it for man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? Do you hear that? Whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and the gospel will save it. None of us want to lose our lives. So perhaps it's the work of God in our life to pry it out of our hands. True Christian discipleship, as far as I can tell, is not about a difficult to-do list of spiritual tasks. It is not about following Jesus, or at least just following Jesus as he lived. It's about following Jesus as he died. It is about being crucified with Christ, rising again. That can look like a person giving up on their hopes, on leaving New York City, coming to Tyler. It can look like being crushed by life into a position where you can truly see God at work. But you don't have to succeed to get ahead. God loves you for who you are, not for what you do. And he's found in failure and weakness. And now, I mean, I think that is a tremendously comforting word to people who are suffering, to people who are truly dealing with repeat offenses. Maybe that's what your marriage feels like. I don't know. I've heard stories. But Jesus presents the paradox of the crucifixion. The true life is found only in its opposite form, death. The way of our trouble is not fighting through it by acquiescing to it. He who loses his life will save it. The death that Jesus died, he died to sin once for all. But the life he lives to God. In the same way, count yourselves dead to sin, but alive to God in Christ Jesus. Now, of course, the good news of the gospel is not the command to let go. Because have you tried letting go? It's really hard. It's really hard. The good news of the gospel is that Jesus let go for our sake. He let go of everything for the sake of men and women who often find themselves unable to let go of the very things that are killing them. Like Marlon, we rarely relinquish control by willpower alone. Instead, we let go when we are grabbed by something greater, by God himself. This is good news for those of us who are paralyzed by fear or anger, by control, or by impossible circumstances. God saves those who cannot save themselves and brings life out of death. And that's the gospel according to Pixar. Tomorrow morning, we're going to talk about inner children. We're going to talk about conversion. We're going to talk about all sorts of exciting, perhaps a little less morose subjects with a lot of humor. So thank you for listening.